Welcome to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I am one of your hosts, Isaac Radansky, CEO and founder of Adventure Media, one of New York's hottest digital advertising agencies, and I am joined, as I usually am, by Patrick Gilbert, Director of Operations and author of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, available in Kindle, paperback, and most importantly, hardcover on Amazon.com right now. Get yourself a copy or two. It makes a great gift. And of course, we are joined by our content queen extraordinaire, Danielle Immerman. And we're here to talk about an exciting topic today, and that is learning and toddlers and the young brain. But Patrick, you don't think that that's a great introduction to the topic, so why don't you start it off, Chief?
Thanks for the introduction, Isaac. Happy New Year. It's our first week back. How you doing?
Good. A little overwhelmed, but I'm happy. I'm happy to be alive, surrounded by excellent people. Very fortunate.
Good. So we chose this topic because it sort of fits into the New Year's resolution sort of vibe. There's a lot of content that you see online right now, especially on LinkedIn, about habits and resolutions. And I think this concept of learning kind of fits into it, because I think a lot of the conversations that we have as far as what we and the people around us want to accomplish in the new year, a lot of it comes back to learning new skills and trying to figure out how to better themselves. But I want to start off by asking, are you a New Year's resolution guy?
I think I'm like a lot of other people that make New Year's resolutions, but I tend to make these types of resolutions all throughout the year. And New Year's is just another time where it's common to do so. But what I like about New Year's resolutions, besides for the obvious fact that they're very hard to keep and most people don't keep them, what I like about New Year's resolutions is that it reveals that humanity wants to be better. Like, people naturally want to be better, because everyone's familiar with the New Year's resolution concept. And it's something that people naturally feel. Like, they want to have a better year. They want their future selves to be more fulfilled. They want their lives to be more productive. And I think that's a very encouraging thing that people don't really focus on. People tend to focus on, well, here's how to make your New Year's resolutions, or here's why you're a failure when you don't keep them, and here's where you went wrong. But I think if you just take a step back, like, how would we know that? How would we know that people want to be better? People have a natural inclination to improve as opposed to just coast or to get by. And I think that the whole movement behind New Year's resolutions proves positive that people naturally want to be better. So that's my thought there.
What I also think is interesting with that is how few people really care about it enough to make a habit out of it. So looking at the opposite in a way, but I think there's an interesting study that comes out every year that shows when people abandon their New Year's resolution. And I think, like, the recurring theme is sometime around January 19th. I think it's like the third Thursday, whatever it is. Like, anyone that picks up a diet generally gives it up by that point, because they're like, yeah, I've been good. I've been working out. I've been eating better, but now I'm going to, like, throw it all away. But I think as part of this, to your point, what makes it such an interesting opportunity is the fact that most people fail at it is enough of a reason to keep going. If you can be the person to pursue, to maintain with your new habits or your new whatever you're trying to embrace on January 20th and the 21st and into February and so on and so forth, then you are actually the exception. And I think, if nothing else, that should be a motivation for a lot of people to say, you know what, I'm not just going to be another person that starts a new thing in January and then gives it up the third week in. I actually want to be one of those few people that carries it on and becomes a better person.
Yeah. And I think that you're going down a little bit of the darker road, which is, you know, 17 days. On one hand, it's pathetic, right? So, like, I could feel both things at once. On one hand, it's bright and encouraging that everyone wants to be better. On the other hand, it's pretty pathetic that we're not very good at doing that. So my feeling is this: to the extent that your New Year's resolution is extrinsically motivated by the day of the year, to that extent, it's going to fail. So there's tactics, right? So, like, I think to some people, your tactic would probably be helpful. It's like, well, if I could put myself in the top 1% by getting past January 17th, that might help for a little bit. What's really going to help is internalization and moving away from it being attached to New Year's. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong or unnatural about an event or a calendar day being a way to start or to attach something to. But if it doesn't become deeper than that, it's bound to fail. It has to fail, because every minute, an hour that event is further behind you, by definition, the less meaningful your resolution becomes. If the motivation for my diet or the motivation for this change in habit is attached to the concept of a new year, January 1, then I'm in big trouble as January 1 gets further behind me, which speaks to like a larger thing in modern culture, in popular culture, in the movies, in books, there's always like a life-changing event. And very few people actually have life-changing events. There's traumatic events, there's traumatic moments that could form or inform our behaviors as we develop. But as far as like a life-changing event that shocks me out of a habit into a new habit, really rare. This has been looked at by people who survived 9/11, where after that, as far as life-changing events goes, that's as big as it's going to get. They made resolutions, whether it be to spend more time with their children or to maintain their health or to focus more on meaningful pursuits, whatever it may be. And people just had the same rate of failure as New Year's resolutions, which is crazy. Surviving 9/11 is a real life-changing event, but it's not. It's not really a life-changing event. So I think a person has to really remind themselves continuously, internalizing it. I'm competing against myself. This is meaningful to me. It's important to me. I'm playing the long game. We talked about this in the last podcast where resolutions and goals are unrealistic and you expect too much too soon of yourself. You want those immediate types of results. And this is like the classic dieting paradigm. When you don't see the immediate results, it becomes very difficult to maintain. So it has to be at some point internalized, and you could use the day or the event as a starting point. But then it has to be, this has nothing to do with the New Year's resolution. It has nothing to do with the date. It has to do with my own habits.
Exactly. So I think bringing this back to learning, the reason that this came up as a topic is because as part of the larger goal, like one of the larger goals that I personally have for the coming year is to be able to, you know, you and the rest of the team put out more content on a more regular basis. And that's one tangible goal that could sort of be given up because it's a hard thing to tackle. So if you break it down, talked about over the last couple episodes, if you really break that down into smaller pieces to tiny habits, as you might call it, it becomes much more achievable. So for me, someone recently asked me, like, how does anybody continue to put out more and more content on a recurring basis? How do you become good at producing content and come up with ideas? And my answer to that is you need to continue to learn things. Because ultimately, if you just have a brain dump of everything you know, and that's your content, great. And then what are you going to do next week or next month? And I think if you stay curious and you keep educating yourself and you keep developing new skills, then it'll naturally translate into the next thing that you'll be able to put out. So that's me personally. I want to be able to commit to kind of a little bit more education and learning and diving into different areas that I've previously been putting off in my life. And that's one of the things I want to tackle this year. Just on the topic of learning, is there anything, broadly speaking, out whether it's specific to the business or just anything in your personal life, is there anything that you've learned or a skill that you've picked up in the last couple months?
So on a personal level, I would love to take a step back afterwards and talk about learning in general and this concept of curiosity and the article in the Wall Street Journal that you brought up.
We'll get there.
Okay. Okay, but on a personal level, in the last few months, I've made a real effort to learn creative writing. That's been the primary thing that I've tried to learn. I've always been a half decent writer. Like I've always been, again, this is not to pat myself on the back in any way, but I read a lot growing up and I've been a slightly above average writer, but I was never really a good writer or an effective writer. And I've learned by trial and error over the years, but I decided I wanted to really learn the science behind creative writing. So I set out to do that. That's something which I've been working on, let's say over the last year or so, last 6 to 9 months, probably. And that's been really great. And then I've also tried to learn recipes. I tried to learn how to cook a little bit. My brother's a chef. You know, I wasn't trying to steal his thunder, but there's a lot of creativity and art in cooking a lot. And it's just interesting to me. So I've been watching a couple master classes, but I'll say I want to learn how to do this thing. And I'll just watch like a bunch of different YouTube videos on making a hamburger or making this type of egg and tomato dish, whatever it may be. And
very diverse palate you have, Isaac.
It's not really that diverse. I have a very unsophisticated palate. I don't eat fish. I'm very picky. Tomatoes. Although if it's in the form of pizza sauce on pizza, I do.
Of course.
But like I'll watch like 15 or 20 different videos on how to sear a steak or how to sous vide a steak or how to cook a burger. And then I'll go buy the ingredients and I'll practice it. I did it with pizza. Pizza is like, you know, you think what's there with pizza, but it's actually not that easy. to make pizza from scratch and to get it right. What have you learned and what have you been exploring over the last year?
So similarly, I think a lot of people fit into this category because of COVID or whatever else, but I've also been cooking a little bit more. And I like the concept of cooking because I feel like there's few things in life that require such focused attention. Like you can kind of like half-ass learning to play guitar or whatever. But like, if you're not completely dialed in on trying to cook a new recipe, you're going to screw something up and you're going to be really disappointed at the end. So I've been picking more of that up. And I don't know, there's a few different random things that I've been trying to do myself. But I think part of why this is so relevant, there was a really interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this past week about the concept of being a beginner. And this piece, it's disguised as a New Year's resolution piece, similar in the way that this podcast is. But it was really about the psychology of learning and creativity. And they looked at people who wanted to succeed in business or in a given career path. And there's a lot of traits and commonalities among people who perform at a very high level. And one of the things that comes up a lot is they constantly are learning new skills that aren't necessarily related to the actual work that they do. Some of the highest performing people that you'll see on Wall Street also, you know, sing or play piano or do something creative on the weekends. And a lot of these people have just picked it up recently. And it's not necessarily something that was intentional. What happens, what the article dives into, is what happens in the brain when you become a beginner and you start something from scratch. It essentially puts you back to when you're like early childhood development and what happens in developing new neural pathways and starting fresh with a whole different types of creativity that sparks in the brain. And it turns out the best thing that any of us could do is learn how to juggle. This is for whatever reason, the article kept coming back to a lot of these people, like learning how to juggle and toss balls up in the air and catch them. It really sparks a lot of creativity in the brain and something that we really, a lot of people don't naturally get from the time that they learn how to walk. And I think this kind of, as you go down the path, becomes really interesting, right? So like your concept of creative writing or cooking is actually having a meaningful benefit in the way that you are able to be more successful at work. Whether or not you directly realize it or not, you are developing more neural pathways, which sparks more creativity and develops more problem-solving skills. And I think just that concept is something that's really interesting to me.
I think it's very important and people should pay attention to that because there's two layers. There's the obvious linear direct relationship between something you learn that's not work and your work. I'll give you an example. I started learning about creative writing. And when I say creative writing, I mean like fiction. Thinking about story and what makes up good stories and what are the building blocks of a story. You know, one might look at that as entertainment, but it's not true because all of story today in every Hollywood production book goes back to Aristotle's Poetics. And Aristotle's Poetics, and Aristotle was no chum, by the way, if you think he was, anybody listening, he was quite the thinker, took himself quite seriously, and he's quite smart. So much so that I don't really understand anything that he wrote in this book, The Poetics, but it's a 64-page pamphlet that outlines the rules of drama, and it's all pulled from Greek mythology. And you ask any major screenwriter today in Hollywood, any major author, they've all read The Poetics or derivatives of The Poetics or many of the commentaries on The Poetics, on Aristotle's work. One of those derivatives is a book called A Hero with 1,000 Faces, which is a big volume that talks about the hero's journey in any satisfying story. One of the derivatives of that, because even that is a big, dense thing to read, is The Hero's Journey by Christopher Vogler. And he sort of breaks down Hero with 1,000 Faces, which is a derivative of Aristotle's Poetics. And he breaks down the hero's journey into a number of different paths. And it's really interesting because he uses example. He takes Star Wars, and then he takes The Wizard of Oz, and then he takes Beverly Hills Cop, and then he takes Casablanca, and he takes Lord of the Rings. He breaks out the acts and the character design and the hero's journey, and he shows you that in from comedies to romantic comedies to dramas to action to thrillers, all good movies and stories follow a structured system that the protagonist and the antagonist experience. And I learned about this. I read about it. I took it seriously because I just wanted to learn about it. And then it came time to write case studies on our website for our clients. And I realized that I was able to transfer that understanding of the hero's journey to client case studies. And I created a case study template that I ended up sharing in the agency Overdrive, which is a membership community that we have. And it was really well-received lecture, teaching people how to apply concepts from the hero's journey to a business case study when you're trying to communicate on your website the results that you've gotten for a client or a project that you've done, and formatting it and writing it in a more captivating, interesting way where people would actually want to read it and follow and get a compelling picture of what was going on and how you've helped that client.
So this is good. And it shows that you took something kind of that you were personally interested in and were able to directly translate it to the business. But I think the real point here is that doesn't have to be the case.
Yes. So I'm getting it. So that's one layer. That's one layer, which is if you get that, you're great. It's hit or miss, right? Because I don't know, I can't tell you how learning to cook a steak has helped me in the business, but I know it has, because from a neurological perspective, like you pointed out, introducing challenges into the adult life, it activates brain patterns that children experience as they're going from crawling to walking to talking, right? And those are, and I think in the article, he says that you're making your brain more malleable and you're making yourself able to learn more and faster. And it actually increases your capacity for information. It increases your capacity for recall. It increases your capacity for a number of things. And those things are going to impact your business, your life, your relationships, your overall intelligence in ways that you cannot predict and you cannot know. So there's these two layers, right? You have the direct correlation, and then you have indirect correlations, which reminds me of something that I read many years ago, and I didn't really tie it back until I read this Wall Street Journal article that you shared with me. I was reading a biography on Richard Feynman. And for those of you who don't know, Richard Feynman was a theoretical physicist. He worked on things like quantum mechanics, path integral formulations, quantum electrodynamics. He was a scientist. He received the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1965. And obviously a brilliant guy, obviously a scientist. And there was a video of him on YouTube probably like almost a decade ago when I first read his book. It's a really good read. So there was a video that he was talking and he said that, you know, like my friends and my colleagues, they tell me that because I'm so absorbed with mechanics, I'm so absorbed with physics and with science, I've lost the ability to appreciate the beauty of a flower. And he said there was like tears in his eyes as he said this. He said, I think it's just the exact opposite. He said, I think when I look at a flower, I have such an overwhelming sense of its beauty because of the way I've trained my brain to see things and the way I'm able to understand the layers and the complexity and the beauty of it. That idea is very much relates to this concept of training the mind through curiosity to learn new things, to see new things. It introduces a more layered perspective of the world, even in ways that we can't see or perceive or know. So when you challenge yourself to learn a new recipe, or you challenge yourself to learn history or whatever it may be, anything that's interesting to you, you're expanding the capacity and the longevity of your brain. And actually it's linked, learning new things is linked to longer life. That was another thing that they mentioned in that article, which I think is really interesting, which makes sense if you're saying it's an exercise, it's an overall healthy exercise for the brain.
Right. And the lack of doing that kind of creates a narrow-minded way of viewing the world and solving problems. So one of the topics that comes up with this is a study that was done by a psychologist named Carl Duncker in 1945 that's known as the candle problem. So the idea is that a big study that's been replicated, but if you put somebody in a room with a candle, a book of matches, and a box of thumbtacks, and you say, okay, take these materials, and I want you to fix a lit candle to the wall. Go. Now, again, it's a candle, matches, a box of thumbtacks. Now, most people will think, okay, well, I'm going to try and tack the candle to the wall. That's my first guess. And that doesn't work. That fails. The second guess is, okay, now I'm going to get smart. I'm going to use some of these matches to burn the side of the candle and melt it so that I can stick it to the wall. That's how I'm going to fix that. That's me being creative. But ultimately, that's not enough as well. So most people end up getting to a point where they become frustrated and ultimately fail, give up, whatever. Now, the real answer is that if you're presented with those materials just in a different way, so instead of being handed the candle, the matches, the box of thumbtacks, you're being presented with essentially what you're thinking of as three materials. Instead, if I handed you a candle, matches, a pile of thumbtacks, and an empty thumbtack box, now you'll perceive this as four different supplies that you can use. Now, when that happens, that same person that failed in the original experiment is more likely to realize that the real answer here is to use the box, the empty box, and tack that to the wall, which creates a shelf that you can then put the candle in, and then you've accomplished your goal. However, just in the way that you've presented it in the original study makes people not connect the dots there. And that's really where it's so important to increase the level of creativity in the brain so that you can see things from more than just their object function. Now, what's super interesting about this study is that there's one particular cohort that has actually done really well. And this wasn't even uncovered until the year 2000. Now, the original study was done in 1945. So 55 years later, another study was performed that found that five-year-olds were actually succeeding at a very high rate at solving the candle problem with the original three perceived supplies, where they were able to take the thumbtacks out of the box and say, I'm going to use this to create a shelf. Now, that to me is one of the most interesting things that I've ever seen in my life, because what that shows is that children are naturally more creative than adults. The reason for that is because as we grow and as we develop more knowledge and we have more things going on in our lives, we naturally, as a survival instinct, create these heuristic shortcuts that allow us to jump to conclusion and exert less energy when making decisions or just doing things in our lives. So naturally, the brain sees a box of thumbtacks and says, okay, it's a box of thumbtacks, nothing more, and you move on to the next thing. And that is so fundamental to so many issues that we see in life and in business. Even though that sounds incredibly cheesy and way too philosophical, but I do think that that's super important, because there is a significant lack of creativity that we see in general if you just look around. Now, what we do as a company is we're brought in to find creative solutions to complex problems related to digital advertising that our clients are experiencing. There's a lot of simple problems that can be solved in the world. We don't get access to a lot of those because people can solve them themselves. Now, therefore, the lack of the general population's ability to see the box of thumbtacks as to more than it really is both the reason that we exist and also our greatest threat to our existence. If we continue to get stuck in this rut where we're not challenging ourselves to be more creative, we will also fall victim to failing the candle problem. So that is why it's increasingly important, as we kind of study the concept of learning a little bit more in depth, to continue to challenge ourselves to learn new things so that we can continue to essentially think like children and become more creative in the way that we approach solving problems.
And I would add to that point, looking at the study they did with the children, where they put a bunch of children who did not yet know how to walk on the top of a slope, a downwards hill. So the children who are still just crawling, they would, you know, sort of crawl up to the edge. They would see that this is not crawlable, and they would turn around. And then children who had just learned to walk, they would just plunge down the hill. They learned this new skill. They now are, there's courage. What the researchers thought was interesting was two things. One was the overall lack of fear, but two is they didn't revert back to their lesser skill set to solve the problem. They could have crawled, because if they're at the point now in development where they're going to attempt this downhill plunge, you know, once they're able to walk, they've proved that they were willing to attempt it. However, crawling would have solved the solution or solved the problem, although they didn't go and try to crawl. They took the more dangerous route and they tried to walk down the hill, and most of them fell. So this is very interesting to me. And I think I want to read more about this and study more about this, but just on the surface, it's like children A are fearless. And that's something that certainly adults lose for good reason, right?
Tumbling down a mountain is not something that you think is advantageous.
Right. One of my favorite books is Daniel Gilbert's Stumbling on Happiness. And in the beginning, he he says, like, listen, every scientist always starts off some paper or some book saying that the human beings are the only race that does this. And eventually some monkey in a lab proves them wrong and they're embarrassed for the rest of their professional careers. And he says, I'm going to take my stab at the human race point. And he said, the human race is the only species that plans for its future. And he says that you might see squirrels burying acorns, but he said that's a motor, it's a motor response. It's not a conscientious decision to give up something today for the sake of my future self. The human being is the only species in the world that develops that capacity. I'd love to just soak in the hot tub in the middle of the day eating chocolate, but I'm going to get fired and I'm going to be fat. So I won't do that. It's like unique to the human being. So children don't really have that. Like children, fearlessness in children is not recklessness. It's that there's no concept of what me in 5 minutes from now. It looks like fearlessness, but it's really just more like an animal, like living in the moment. So, and you see this on the ski slopes. You see that in that study with children just plunging down a ramp. I see it in my 1.5-year-old. Like children on a pair of skis are just flying with like life-threatening abandon. They'll go off a jump without thinking twice about it. And like we're standing there with piss dribbling down our ski pants, just looking at this stuff because it's so terrifying. The thought of even like getting off the lift, and we just end up taking the lift down, right? That's what we do as adults, because to us, we know we're thinking of the broken neck and the broken legs and the pain. Children are thinking of like how fun this is going to be. And here's a downhill slope. I have skis. It should work. No problem. So it's good that we have this capacity, right? Because it's also what keeps us alive. It's what keeps us safe. But sometimes we get anecdotally, or you take it however you want to take it. Sometimes we get too concerned about failure. We tend to overestimate the damage of failure. And in fact, what is like one of the most common feedback you hear from a friend or somebody you go to for advice? What do they tell you? What's the worst that can happen? Like I find myself saying this all the time. I say it all the time to people at the company. I say it to my wife, say it to my kids. Like, what's the worst that could happen? They're going to say no. You're going to get rejected. You're going to lose the client. You're going to, you know, like what's the worst? And when you actually stop and think rationally about the worst that can happen, you realize that it's really not that bad. And it's a good tactic for getting over your fear of if you're going to go and introduce yourself to a new person or you're going to take a gamble, what's the worst that could happen? It's usually not that bad. So see, there's two things here that children are very good at. They don't worry about the fear of failure. They don't have a conceptualization of the future self. So we as adults hopefully do have a conceptualization of the future self. So we should not forget the future self, although we should use our brains to rationally think through what is the worst case scenario. And is that really all that bad? Will it ruin my life? Probably not. The second thing kids do well is they forget the trauma of past failures very quickly. Like they're not thinking of crawling again. Like it's crawling's not an option. I've crawled, it didn't work. Now I'm moving on. You see this with children. This happened last week. My 1.5-year-old daughter was sitting on a chair. She started jumping on the chair, fell over off the chair, smashed her head. She was screaming for 10 minutes, had a big bump. The very next day, she wanted to get back up on the chair and started jumping again. It's like they don't remember failing. If they remember it, it doesn't freaking bother them. And that's another incredible life skill that we should borrow more frequently from children. Again, it's good. We need to remember that this is sharp. Adults have to remember that putting your hand to the fire is going to hurt, because that's how we survive and we thrive and we preserve life. But we should, in business and even in life, and like you said, it sounds cheesy, but we should try to somehow block out the leftover trauma of past failures and keep your perspective towards the future as much as possible. Obviously, it's a balance, because the way businesses grow and people grow is by also learning from the mistakes and adapting and not repeating the same mistake over and over again. However, there's many times where people have failed. They'll block off that route from themselves indefinitely and in all circumstances. Let's apply to a personal example from Adventure Media. We had the opportunity to pitch a very large client, right? So this client was orders of magnitude larger than any of our existing clients. It was not a client that we were likely to win for many different reasons. Now, we lost that account. Now, many people would say, you know what? It was a waste of money. It was a waste of time. Anytime now we get a client that's 11 times larger or more than any of our existing clients, or the statistical likelihood is less than 20% of us winning the account, we're not going to pitch. Now, my personal attitude is you should focus forward. Don't close off opportunities from yourself because you're tainted from prior failures, unless you could really predict with a degree of accuracy that you're going to fail again. And in another example, let's say with hiring, we've hired people and for certain reasons it didn't work out, and you might have a new candidate that maybe the argument could be made that they're the same, but there's arguments that could be made that they're not the same. And you want to be careful that you're not over inflating prior failures and letting the tentacles of failure seep into other areas of your life and other decisions, similar to what children do.
And I think it's important to recognize when those heuristic shortcuts are taking place, to your point about, hey, you know, this client seems very much like the other one that failed, or this potential hire seems very much like that other team member that didn't work out. And I think instead of just jumping to the gun and saying, well, therefore, I'm going to make this conclusion, to take a second and reflect on the fact that you are internalizing this shortcut and to try and play devil's advocate with yourself to see how actually is this different. This is a unique situation this time. To at least recognize that that is taking place is extremely meaningful and will help lead to better outcomes. So I think what we've covered here to kind of pull this all around is, as we go into this new year, I think just from a business perspective, like not even on a personal level, like one of the things that I'm looking at and thinking a lot about is how do we continue to stay sharp at our craft? We happen to work in an industry that moves very quickly, and the things that worked for us a year ago might not work tomorrow. And it's something that gives me a great deal of anxiety to know that we have to continue to try new things and learn new things and get better and better and better as time goes on. And the question is, how do you keep up with that? How do you keep the stamina to continue to do that? And I think my best guess for that is to continue to learn and challenge yourself to become more creative. Then the next question is, how do you be more creative? And believe it or not, if you just look at the psychology of it, it's really learning about anything. It doesn't have to be specifically related to the work. You don't necessarily need to take a creative writing course. You don't necessarily need to become the best whatever. You don't have to take a course at night to learn XYZ thing for your field. As long as you stay curious and continue to challenge yourself to become a beginner at something and learn new skills, then you will increase your own creativity and your ability to solve problems as they continue to develop and get more complicated as time goes on. So that's my personal takeaway. I think that's my advice for the general public. Continue to act like a child, think like a child, and hopefully it works out in 2021.
You've been listening to the How to Hide a Dead Body podcast. I am your host, Isaac Radansky, CEO of Adventure Media, and I was joined today by Patrick Gilbert, author of Join or Die, Digital Advertising in the Age of Automation, available on Amazon. Patrick is also the Director of Operations at Adventure Media, and Danielle, our content queen, moderator, and editor and syndicator of this podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode. If you have any suggestions for topics that you'd like to hear about, shoot us an email, message us on social platforms. I ain't no Facebook kid, so someone else will find it. Thanks for listening. And last question to you, Patrick. What's the best place to hide a dead body?
On the second page of Google.
Everyone knows that.